Hey, what happened to the defense attorney? Was it, was he or she asleep?
Well, and that's why the context of this situation is important to note. These matters were done very, the change to the plea negotiations, which was a very significant substantive change, was made very hastily. And
in what sense was it a very substantive change in the plea?
Well, the prior negotiations, that were done in February 2013, the state had offered the defendant an opportunity to take a plea of a class. This is a robbery offense. So they gave him the opportunity to take a to plead to a lesser charge of attempted battery, which was a class D felony. And at that time, the state stipulated that they would only be seeking 12 months jail time and would waive all PSI requirements. So when that deal was laid on the table in February, our client, Mr. Ledua, rejected that deal because he believed that he had a viable self-defense based on the information that came out in the preliminary hearing. Now, we're 2 months later, our client wants his bail reduced, and he agrees that he'll accept the plea agreement. So, based on the record, it was his understanding when it goes into court that morning on April 4th that this is still the agreement that we have, the gross misdemeanor, the max 12 months. But when we look at the preliminary hearing transcript, his attorney says, wait a minute, Judge, I looked at the plea agreement. It doesn't really comport to my understanding of what the negotiations were. He says that last night I talked to the DA's office, and they said that they'll only agree to this if he stipulates the felony treatment on this voluntary offense. So we have the attorney there admitting that even the attorney himself didn't know that that was going to be a stipulation until the night before. And then we also found out from that the client's finding out for the first time, wait a minute, this isn't going to be just a gross misdemeanor, it's going to be a felony treatment. And so at that point, we have the district court judge who makes the decision, well, do you want to trial this? Do you need a few minutes to discuss this? The attorney discusses it with his client, and then that's how we get to this plea agreement. So the client goes from rejecting 12-month jail plea agreement to, in a matter of a few minutes, accepting an agreement which would, where he could face 1 to 4 years prison time.
Counsel, in this matter, there seemed to be some confusion. The court acknowledged that, but he had gave them time. I thought it was moved to the back of the calendar for them to go back through to see if there was, in fact, confusion. And part of the confusion seemed to be the fact that Mr. Ledua, his understanding was that he was going to be released, and that had to be altered and changed, and that was done. I'm having a problem because outside of some minor things, what we finally arrive at, which he acknowledged in the canvas, was what he had asked for in the final view. So why should we now look to set this aside when we seem to, what we have is cold feet, because he didn't honor one of the primary things, which was he would show up for his sentencing after his release, which he chose not to, to just have it tossed out.
And I'd like to, that's an important point, and it's a point that the state has raised too. I'd like to draw your attention to the fact that the state argues that the only reason he wants to withdraw his guilty plea is because he failed to appear for a PSI interview. The PSI interview was part of that interlineated handwritten change on the plea agreement. Again, a change that was sort of made at the last minute.
The counsel and the canvassing of the defendant, isn't that told to him that he has an obligation to go to parole and probation, and did not the court walk him through that plea agreement for his assent on the record?
Yes, and the court does mention that the PSI is part of the plea agreement. However, when we look at the circumstances there, at that time, bail is being lowered, and the court also asked him on record, are you planning on bailing out soon? Because that was going to determine the next sentencing date. And it was the attorney and the client's position that he was going to be bailing out soon. However, he wasn't able to raise money for the bail. And so we also see in the record there's a minute order from May of 2013 where it shows that Mr. Lodeau is still present and in custody. So at that time, 6 weeks later, he's still in custody. He still hasn't bailed out. There is no and our client informed us that he didn't receive any paperwork for a PSI interview, a date and a time and a place. And so he's sitting in jail for 6 weeks. That could have been given to him at any time. Apparently, it wasn't.
So our test here today is to determine whether or not the district court acted properly. So my question is, given the confusion, which sadly is not unusual in our district courts, and the opportunities that this defendant had and the responses, I mean, the colloquy between the judge and the defendant when he entered his plea is very straightforward. And that's what we have to look at. What else would you have this court tell the district courts that they need to do in order to be sure that, number one, the defendant is making a knowing and voluntary plea, and number two, if in fact the time comes when the defendant chooses to seek to withdraw his or her plea, what would you have the judge do that the judge didn't do in this case?
Well, in this case, since the change was substantive and really made a major changes to a possible sentencing, I think that it would have behooved the court to not just give the defendant a few minutes to consider the change, but to make the decision at that point to put it on for next calendar.
So how do we create a test that will properly inform our district court judges, look for this, this, and this, and in the event that you see those things in a defendant as he or she is entering the plea, you need to continue it to another day? I mean, what we decide has to be something that is, of course, fact-specific to your client's case, but also has to be something that is that our district judges can use. I'm looking hard to find something that the district judge didn't do here, and frankly, I'm not seeing it.
Okay. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal time at this time also, but I want to answer your question.
4:45, but go ahead and answer Justice Sade's question, if you would.
Okay. I think one of the tests and one of the issues here is that the fact that the sentence time and the treatment was moved from a misdemeanor to a felony. I think that's felony carries certain consequences that misdemeanors don't.
So that happens all the time in district court. You know, I mean, that's the very nature of a robbery and deals that are made. If you do this, you're going to get the likelihood of a gross, and if not, you're going to get the felony. So that's, again, my trouble is I don't know how we help our judges to know when they should or when they shouldn't do certain things.
Any other questions, colleagues?
I do have one. Okay. As you know, Ms. Long, this case comes to the court after having been heard by the Court of Appeals, and your office presented a petition for review of the Court of Appeals decision, maintaining that the Court of Appeals decision applied the wrong standard in assessing the voluntariness of the guilty plea agreement in this case. What standard did the Court of Appeals apply, and what standard do you agree that the standard should be the one enumerated in Crawford versus State?
Well, we believe that the district court should have applied a relaxed standard.
I'm sorry, my question went to the Court of Appeals.
Well, I guess the standard is whether or not the district court abused its discretion. And we believe that it did abuse its discretion because...
But do you agree that the standard is enunciated in Crawford as the standard we should use, which is whether the canvas coupled with a detailed, consistent written plea agreement supports a finding that the defendant's plea voluntarily and knowing was voluntary, knowing, and intelligent?
The court actually issued an opinion in the fall of 2015 in Stevenson, mm-hmm. which actually expanded that rule slightly more. It says that you don't just need to look at a review of just the plea versus the canvas, but to look at a totality of the circumstances, which could include things outside of the plea and canvas.
Are we talking about pre-sentencing versus post-sentencing?
I'm talking about pre-sentencing.
So you're saying it should be a relaxed standard pre-sentencing as opposed to post-sentencing?
Yes.
Any other questions? Okay, we chewed into your time. I'm going to give you two additional minutes.
Thank you.
Okay, and counsel, I'll extend the extra 2 minutes to you as well.
Good morning. May it please the court, my colleagues. My name is Nicole Canizaro, and I am a deputy district attorney with the Clark County District Attorney's Office, and I'm here on behalf of the state of Nevada, the respondent in this matter. Your Honor, in each and every criminal case, the solemn entry of a guilty plea by the accused must be undertaken seriously and should not be unbound absent clear circumstances to substantiate that a defendant could not have understood the process, could not have comprehended the consequences of the plea, or could not have knowingly, intentionally, intelligently, and voluntarily entered into the negotiations such that there was no meeting of the minds, and that to go forward with a plea in place would compromise the very judicial system that we operate within every day.
You do agree that pre-sentence, you look at the totality of the circumstances?
Your Honor, this court's decision in Stevenson v. State clearly not only discussed Crawford v. State, which is still good law in the state of Nevada, which focused whether or not a substantial, fair, just reason was present on the voluntariness of the plea, whether it was intentionally entered and whether it was knowingly entered, but also sort of expanded that into the totality of the circumstances.
And how does that play into this case, in your opinion?
Yes, Your Honor. Even under Stevenson v. State, which was not discussed by the Court of Appeals when they did render their order of affirmance, this case, nevertheless, the district court did not abuse its discretion when it considered all of the circumstances surrounding the defense plea. A couple of things I would note for the court is that first and foremost, when the defendant initially entered into negotiations, this occurred at the justice court level. During the preliminary hearing in justice court, the defendant and the party, the counsel for the state, defense counsel and counsel for the state, stopped in the middle of the hearing and requested to have a brief recess in order to discuss negotiations, mid-testimony of a witness. During that conversation, the parties agreed that the defendant would plead guilty to an amended charge of an attempt battery resulting in substantial bodily
harm. How is that relevant here when a deal fades? Why do we go back and talk about deals? I mean, suppose you're not supposed to talk about settlement negotiations.
Sir.
And here you are talking about settlement negotiations that failed.
And one of the reasons why it's relevant is because repeatedly the appellant has asserted that he was confused by the plea agreements in this case because initially in the preliminary hearing he was offered certain plea negotiations and that complicated things thereafter. From the state's perspective, once the defendant agreed to be bound over to district court, he was advised by the justice court that if he were to back out of the negotiations, that he would have to face the original charges. And I would direct this court's attention to the fast track appendix or the appellant's appendix at pages 0015 and 0016. On those pages is the discussion that the justice court had with the defendant to advise them that if he was going to accept the negotiations and be bound over to district court, that if he ever backed out of those negotiations, he would proceed in district court. Appellant has made light of the fact that he believed that throughout this process he was facing only gross misdemeanor charges or that he was entitled somehow to that gross misdemeanor treatment, and that's why it's relevant.
Because the history is really nice. But the relevance for us is what happened at the district court level, because that's where he enters the plea to this matter.
Yes.
So how is what happened at the district court, what should we look at there to show that this is a good deal or, in fact, consider what is being advocated by the appellate?
Yes, Your Honor. And at the district court, procedurally, the defense was offered a negotiation by the state. I would note that prior to those negotiations, an amended information was filed at the district court level that charged the defendant with a felony offense of battery resulting in substantial bodily harm. That's a C felony. So these negotiations did not contemplate at any point in time that he would still be entitled to the gross misdemeanor treatment. That's important because during the district court colloquy and the entry of plea, there was no mention by any of the parties that the defendant understood that he was pleading to a gross misdemeanor. In fact, if you look at the canvas from the district court, it's even the defendant who's supplying the answers that he understands he's pleading to a felony. And when he is asked by the court specifically what the range of term of penalty that he could face, the court asks, at the time of sentencing, what is your understanding of the range of sentence that the court could impose? The defendant supplies the answer of 12 to 48. The court then says 12 to 48, 1 to 4 years. The defendant responds, yes. There was never a mention at the district court level whatsoever at any point during the plea canvas, nor during the negotiations, nor on part of the defendant, nor on part of the defense counsel, that the defendant ever understood he was entering into a gross misdemeanor treatment. That plea agreement that he was given in the lower level arraignment back in February of 2013 was never signed by the parties, was never filed by the court, and was never agreed to by the defendant, nor was he canvassed on it. So at the district court, when he receives the guilty plea agreement, he is in fact pleading to a robbery charge, so either a Category D felony or a gross misdemeanor. Some of the other things, and I know Justice Sata brought this up, what other things can the court potentially look at? And in this case, Your Honors, when the court was deciding the motion to withdraw plea, not only did it look at the plea canvas, which from the plea canvas, it's hard to imagine that there would be another circumstance where a plea canvas was more clear as to what the defendant was pleading to. He was stipulating to felony treatment because he wanted to get out of custody. That was a conversation that the parties had during the course of negotiations, which frequently happens when you are in court, especially during calendar calls.
Well, in fact, on the April 4th plea agreement, it's written in there that he stipulates that this crime is to be given felony treatment at sentencing. Isn't that correct? And that was part of the canvas?
That is absolutely correct. And he was only ever canvassed on seeking felony treatment. Now, there was also some indication during the course of the hearing that maybe he was confused about the consequences of his plea. Again, the state would refer this court to the appellant's appendix at 0064 to 0068 for the canvas in district court. Aside from that canvas, however, it bears noting that during the course of these proceedings, once the defendant entered his plea, he at no time made any mention to his counsel nor sought to put the matter on calendar in order to ask to withdraw his plea, even after he was unable to make bail. More importantly, the state would note that on May 23rd, 2013, that was a motion that was filed on behalf of the defendant, or on behalf of the appellant by defense counsel, that sought to move the sentencing date forward because the defendant could not bail out of custody. At no point during that motion was there ever any indication that the defendant wished to withdraw his plea, or that he misunderstood the negotiations, or that there was something confusing within that entry of plea. Additionally, the state would note that during the argument on the motion to withdraw plea, other things that the court certainly did take into consideration when rendering its opinion is the fact that this appellant had previously entered into two prior plea negotiations in the state of Nevada for felony offenses. So the idea that he was confused by the section of the plea agreement which read consequences of the plea is certainly belied by the record.
Well, the fact is the judge said he was confused.
And then,
how do we get around the fact that the judge says, you're confused, but I'm not going to let you withdraw your plea?
I would direct this court to take a look at the canvas and the minutes from, or not the canvas, pardon me, the minutes from the motion to withdraw plea argument. The court states that it was confused with whether or not the defendant could have potentially been confused, and although the appellant states that the court made a specific finding that the defendant was confused, that too is belied by the record. The court in the motion to withdraw plea asked the state specifically mid-argument to address the fact that it could be possible, according to the fact that the guilty plea agreement had been amended, had been interlineated, the defendant was potentially confused, and could we address that? Further argument by the state and both by defense counsel ferreted out that not only did we look at the plea canvas, but we also looked at what happened during the course of the proceedings, and the defendant clearly understood what he was entering into.
Why did the parties write in, defendant stipulates that this crime is to be given felony treatment at sentencing, further if he doesn't show up, he's going to go to prison. Why did they continue the case to have this typed in correctly like most plea agreements, instead of having it at a last minute type thing?
Yes, Your Honor. I would note that this did occur at calendar call, and during the course of the hearing, defense counsel actually offered to the court, and the state did not have an objection to, did not state an objection to, requesting to move this matter to Friday date so that the defendant could have enough time to discuss it with his attorney. Judge Bixler at that time asked the defense counsel to have a conversation with the defendant in order to further ferret out whether or not he could understand the plea agreement, and at the end of that conversation, there was no request to pass this case until a Friday date.
But this man was in custody at the time, right?
That is correct.
How do you have a conference when your client's in custody? I mean, where was the conference? In the jury box with the other people listening?
And, Your Honor, I would note that this case had been going on for 4 months from the time the defendant was arrested until he pled guilty. Mr. Percival had many chances and, in fact, spoke with him on a number of occasions.
Don't you think it was an obligation on the district attorney to say, you know what, Your Honor, I don't care what the defendant wants. I want time to revise this plea agreement and to have it typed and to have this man have a chance to talk to his attorney. Don't you think that's fair?
And, Your Honor, that certainly could have been a request that was made.
Is that the best practice, though?
With respect to plea agreements, Your Honor, during the course of a district court calendar, there are little changes that are made to plea agreements that do occur within the jury box. Additionally, at preliminary hearings, it's not uncommon for defense counsel to have conversations with their clients within the jury box or outside of the courtroom or in an anteroom. Certainly, there is no Nevada case law to which the state is aware that will require a particular amount of time in order for a defendant to clearly understand the terms of the agreement. And in this case, the appellant, having been familiar with plea agreements and how they operate, certainly wouldn't have required the same amount of time as another particular accused. Nor, in this case, was this the first time that Mr. Percival had ever spoken with the defendant about this case. The request on behalf of the appellant to be released from custody, the state agreed to with the condition that he would stipulate to felony treatment and would stipulate to prison time should he be released. Additionally, I would like to note that this case goes to...
Can I ask one question about that point?
Yes.
I assume that he had been granted bail prior to his appearance in district court. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, he had been granted bail.
And then was that status changed to an OR release?
No, Your Honor, it was reduced to, I believe, a $3,000 bail, which would have been standard bail on the charge.
And what was the original bail amount?
I do not recall what the original bail was, but it was higher than $3,000.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Do you know if the certificate of counsel, Mr. Percival's certificate, was executed before or after the delineation on the plea agreement?
I believe it was executed after. The way that this plea occurred was the copies of the guilty plea agreement were given to defense counsel. They again asked and requested for the defendant to receive a reduced bail or for an owner cognizance release, and the state agreed to reduce bail with the condition the defendant would stipulate to felony treatment. So that interlineation occurred before anyone ever signed the guilty plea agreement. That interlineation was signed by both the defense attorney and the defendant, and he was canvassed about that by Judge Bixler. The only other thing I did want to note briefly was that there was some indication that a PSI never would have been required in this case, but that's quite the contrary as well. That was not something that was added as part of the negotiations in this case. Because the defendant was pleading to a robbery offense and was stipulating to felony treatment, pursuant to statute, he would have been required to complete a PSI interview or a pre-sentence investigation interview with the Department of Parole and Probation. The defendant clearly understood that that was something he was required to do. Not only was it contained within the guilty plea agreement to which he signed, but he was also canvassed on it by the judge. Furthermore, the appellant also filed a motion with a specific request to move up the sentencing date in order to complete a pre-sentence investigation report.
With respect to the standard of review and whether or not the Court of Appeals got it wrong, I presume that you agree that they applied the correct standard of review and, in fact, reached the right result?
Yes, Your Honor. They did apply the correct standard of review. The correct standard of review in this case, both by the Court of Appeals and by this Court, would be to review it for an abuse of discretion on part of the District Court. Certainly, the Appellate Court did not, in its order of affirmance, detail or discuss at length the Stevenson case. However, I would note that according to the facts in this particular case, even the totality of the circumstances between the plea, the procedural history of this case, the appellant's own understanding of the guilty plea agreement, certainly under the totality of the circumstances, this plea was a valid, voluntary plea.
So could you address something for me, please? Looking at the plea agreement, which is interlineated, what is the operative effect of the language at lines 24 through 27 on page 2, which states, if the court elects to treat this offense as a felony or as a gross misdemeanor, I understand that I am eligible for probation for the offenses to which I am pleading guilty. I understand that, except as otherwise provided by statute, the question of whether I receive probation is in the direction of the sentencing judge. Was the judge still permitted under this plea agreement to treat this as a lawful?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that's not uncommon. In fact, this court has indicated that a sentencing judge has the wide discretion to determine an appropriate sentence, and so long as that sentence is within the prescription of the statute, it's deemed a valid and legal sentence, despite what the parties may agree to or stipulate.
So what is the meaning of defendant stipulates that this crime is to be given felony treatment at sentencing?
And you know, that's the agreement between the parties. That is what the state and the defense counsel are both recommending to the district court in terms of sentencing. Certainly, the district court judge has the discretion to not follow those negotiations, and it's not uncommon for a district court judge to not follow negotiations and to instead impose a different sentence than to what the parties have agreed to.
But at sentencing, the judge didn't even consider the wobbler.
Correct, Your Honor. At sentencing, both parties had the right to argue. The reason for that was not only did the defendant fail to appear for his pre-sentence investigation report, but he also at the time of sentencing had picked up additional charges. At that point, not only did the defendant not comply with the terms of the agreement, but there is portions of the guilty plea agreement which would entitle the state to retain the right to argue. Judge Bixler made a finding that the state had retained its right to argue, and so at sentencing, the parties, both sides, had the right to argue to the judge what they believed the appropriate sentence to be.
I must say, frankly, I'm a bit confused as to what the defendant pled to. The crime is to be treated as a felony, but it's still going to be considered a wobbler.
Well, Your Honor, he's pleading to a wobbler offense, and I see that I am running out of time.
Go ahead and
finish the question.
Answer the question.
When the defendant is pleading to a particular crime, in this case it is attempt battery with substantial bodily harm, that crime that he's pleading to is a wobbler offense, or what we refer to as a wobbler offense. However, a robbery offense can either be treated as a gross misdemeanor or as a felony. When he's stipulating to treatment, his plea to the robbery offense doesn't change, but his stipulation to how that offense would be treated certainly does. The state does have an obligation, and the court does have an obligation, to canvass the defendant on the particular consequences of a plea. So any plea agreement where there is a robbery offense, the defendant would receive notification and certainly be aware of the fact that he could be treated as a gross misdemeanor or as a felony. But as noted by the plea canvas in this case by Judge Bixler, he specifically explained to the defendant that he would be stipulating to felony treatment.
Well, then, but where are you as a contract matter? And plea agreements are treated as contracts. We generally try to give meaning and content to every word of the text and try to read it harmoniously. It seems to me, just as a plain contract matter, that there is some inconsistency between the defendant's handwritten interlineation that says, I acknowledge this would be treated as a felony, and the language on page 2 to which Justice Hardesty is directing your attention, as well as language up on page 2 that's higher up that also goes through that he could be treated as a gross misdemeanor or a felony. If this were just a written contract for the commercial deal, I would think the gross misdemeanor language as something that might still occur would have been crossed out, because it really has no meaning if you're going to freight the handwritten interlineation as you have in saying it's only going to be a felony and that's where you are. Do you follow my question?
Yes.
So really, to read this faithfully to your interpretation, we have to kind of erase the references to gross misdemeanor, correct?
Not quite, Your Honor.
Okay.
No, if I may just know.
Yes.
In this case, the reason why there is language regarding the gross misdemeanor treatment is because at the end of the day, the sentencing judge has the wide discretion to even go so far as to ignore the party's agreement to a stipulation of felony treatment and to treat it as a gross misdemeanor. It would be the same effect as if someone were pleading to an offense that was probationable, but to which the parties were agreeing to prison time. Certainly they'd be canvassed on the fact that the offense itself is probationable, but that the agreement of the parties was that they would
comply. Why did you need this language then? What did you need this language for? You didn't need this language at all. This, if it was a binding plea, and then the judge gave a gross misdemeanor, you then could say, we're not going to, the plea agreement, there's no deal. But why did they put this language in? You didn't need it with this plea agreement.
And you know, my understanding is the reason why that language is included within the consequences of the plea is that the district court judge still has the discretion to sentence the defendant on either the gross misdemeanor or the felony treatment for the robbery offense.
Can I ask one more question?
Certainly.
I have one additional question. In this, in the state's response to the court's concern that the defendant was still confused or was confused, the state says this: what was discussed specifically with the defendant was that he was pleading the Wadler offense and that he was stipulating to felony treatment. So in effect, the defendant was not going to be, he was pleading to a Wadler, but he was agreeing he was going to be sentenced as a felon.
Yes.
Then it says, and getting a bail reduction in return for that.
Yes.
I don't, maybe I missed it, but I don't see any discussion in the plea agreement about the bail reduction or the change in his bail status. Did I miss something?
No, you did not. The agreement between the parties for the bail reduction was stated on the record during the course of the plea canvas.
I mean, should a judge take into account, sorry, Chief, just want to wrap up that one question. Should a judge take into account when making a Stevenson and evaluation of the voluntariness of the plea, the change in bail status as a condition for changing the plea?
Certainly, the defendant...
Did the judge in this case do that?
He did, Your Honor. And I would note, Justice Perrier, I know you requested if the defendant had been given the bail reduction. He did, and he was released.
Caller?
colleagues, any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for your time.
Let me ask this question without your time being used. Why do you let this be a fast-track case? I mean, there seems to be a lot of issues here that could have been covered in a 30-page brief and a 30-page reply. Why did you read it fast-track?
Because I would have to look at the fast-track standard again. It was my understanding that since the law is clear on the ability to withdraw a guilty plea, it's not really raising any sort of novel issues of the law. It's more of a fact determination.
Did your client believe this was a binding plea, that the judge was bound by this, even though the language later in the plea agreement says he's not bound? Do you have any idea what the client thought?
Well, obviously the client was confused about whether or not he was bound to follow any treatment. Am I on the record now?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So as part of the consequences of plea, it says that it can be the judge can treat it either as a misdemeanor or a felony. Obviously, this is actually inconsistent with that respect because the judge does not canvass him on the fact that he may treat it as a misdemeanor. The judge only mentions the 12 to 48 sentence. There's no mention that the judge could, at his discretion, withdraw that sentence.
But so
that
was another inconsistency. The judge did say, quote, he stipulated to felony treatment. That would have been the time for counsel to say, no, not so much, if in fact that was the case. I mean, that was on the record. So, again, I'm just confused about what else should have been done.
Well, actually, I mean, look, I think this court laid out in ADKT 411 their performance standards with regard to private consultations with defendants. I think, going to an earlier question, that the defendant should have been given time to have a private consultation with their attorney.
ineffective assistance of counsel case.
Well, not necessarily, because all of the attorney's actions that might have been considered ineffective were made in front of a district court judge at the district court judge's approval. So if the attorney was ineffective, then the judge may have had some errors, too, in allowing that assistance. I mean, the judge was completely aware that this issue could be treated as a misdemeanor.
Isn't this a case where the client would have done anything, signed anything to get that bail reduction? Isn't that what we're really looking at here? That he wanted out, and then because he was out, he didn't show PNP.
Well, I mean, the bail reduction is definitely carried on a stick that is influential on his decision. You know, a lot of clients will take anything, you know, to get out of jail at that point. But we already know, though, that he did reject a plea agreement that would only have given him a jail term of up to 12 months and because he believed that he had a viable self-defense. There's one brief point I wanted to make with respect to when appellant's attorney signed the plea agreement. And I just wanted to note that there are two plea agreements that are signed both by the appellant, both by his counsel, and both by the DA's office that were both filed in open court. And so one of those plea agreements doesn't have the interlineated changes, and the other does have interlineated changes. So
talking about failure in April.
No, I'm talking about April 4th, and that's in the record.
That's the interlineated agreement.
There are actually two agreements that were entered on April 4th, and that was part of our record as to why there was some confusion, because it's obvious that both his attorney, both the DA's office, and both our client signed the agreement at one point without those interlineated changes, and that there must have been another copy that a change was made, and then it was signed. However, as far as timing, we don't know from the record whether or not when that agreement was actually signed. Was it signed before the interlineated changes or after?
When was the agreement to reduce the bail? Was it at that day of the plea hearing? Or was it before? Do you know?
I believe it was that day of the plea agreement.
One last question, hypothetically. If we were to find the plea agreement invalid and non-voluntary and this goes back, what happens? The state can pursue this and take it to trial?
The state would presumably go to trial, and then our client would be able to put on a defense. He believes he's entitled to a self-defense argument, and that's where we would go from there.
Very good. Colleagues, any other questions? All right. Thank you both for your presentation and briefing. This matter will stand.